Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens.
So that episode with Simon Thackery, we've called it Saying It As It Is, because he does.
He's just, I thought it was fascinating, you know, his story to where he got to.
Yeah.
And lots of insights, not about dentistry, about regulation of dentistry, about maybe the future of dentistry. Really informative, but in a really nice chap. You know, I can't think of any other way. You know, sometimes you can have discussions, can't you, with people, not on our podcast, I used to add, that are a little bit dry and a little bit dull. But he was able to communicate really well, really effectively.
I also love what he had to say about his practice and the importance of general dentistry, general practice, how that supports your local community, but also how that gives you longevity.
Yes.
Yeah, that gives you, you know, a standing in your community, come good times or bad, through recessions. That's the thing that served him well. So it was a really brilliant conversation.
Really good one for
some of his thoughts
to.
Around, you know, government and the future of dentistry. And this is for somebody who has been in the profession for, you know, a good few decades. He's
and
been
has,
around and
has
he
got
knows.
Experience and a voice to be heard.
Absolutely. No, always.
Brilliant.
Absolutely
good stuff.
Fabulous conversation. I'm looking forward to this one.
I think, can we fit it into one episode?
I think
is where
he's a
we
very
start.
Shy and retiring individual. We might have to tease answers out to some of these questions.
I'm not too sure he'll answer some of the questions. He might just give us monosyllabic answers.
Well, let's see how we go. So today, ladies and gentlemen, we are joined by Dr. Simon Thackery. Simon is a dentist, as many of you will know, also the principal and clinical director of Thackery Dental Care in Mansfield and the secretary and president-elect of the British Association of Private Dentistry and also podcast host with Rachel Darby. Welcome, Simon. How are you doing?
Thank you. Very well. Thanks, guys. Thanks for inviting me.
No, looking forward to it.
Looking forward to it.
We've got a lot to get through and not a lot of time, so we should crack on, shouldn't we?
Yeah, sure.
You characterise yourself as a Yorkshireman who has a habit of telling like it is, which I love, and it's true as well. I've never had a conversation with you where you haven't been quite forthright in your opinion on whatever subject we've been talking about. But before we get back to
the Jeff boycott of the dentistry world.
Yeah, but before we get to the dental bit, let's kind of stick with the Yorkshireman thing and take us back, because I think quite often people say it's kind of postcode, parents and education are the things that kind of set us up from the very beginning. What was your childhood like? How did it all start for you?
Born and bred in Sheffield. My family had always come from sort of a working class background. And my dad had worked his way through the company that he, when he left school, his education was interrupted because of the war, obviously. So he joined a company as post boy in the post room. And then they kept the job open for him for 2 years while he did his national service in Hong Kong. And eventually went on to be the secretary and financial director of the company as it got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Oh, wow. What a story.
Oh, cool.
Sort of a rags to riches. Not so much riches, because I wouldn't have said I had a privileged childhood from that point of view. It was a comprehensive education. We didn't do things like holidays abroad or anything like that. It was a childhood of the 70s.
Wow.
Affected by various things like, the recession at the time.
Three-day week, power cuts.
Well, that's it. My dad worked in the refractories industry. So, of course, there was steel. And it was very susceptible to things like the strikes, coal strikes, things like that, and the power cuts. So there was always a little bit of fear that as British industry was actually falling over, which was during my childhood, you know, what would happen? My mum had given up her career to bring me and my sister up. Mm. She used to be Roy Hattersley's secretary.
No.
Oh, wow. But, really?
Yeah, he used to be in charge of the blood transfusion service in Sheffield. She was his secretary. And when he left to join Parliament, she got his job. So she ran the blood transfusion service in Sheffield for a while.
Wow.
Brilliant.
And then, my childhood then was just based on there was a sort of expectation that I'd be one of the first to, in the family to go to university because...
Were you smart your parents as a kid then?
I was reasonably clever. I was a bit of a swat, I suppose. I never thought I was. I just sort of knuckled down. And some things sort of quite straightforward. General knowledge has always been one of those things that I've got this capacity for stupid.
I always think it's quite fascinating. So if you look at like if those listeners, you've no idea what Roy Hattersley is, go and have a look at him because he would not fit into politicians of today.
No, God, no. This is that forthright Yorkshireman kind of thing. And they, you know, he would say what he needed to say. You wouldn't necessarily agree with what he said. I remember meeting the Beast of Bolsover.
Wow.
What's his name?
Dennis Skinner. Wasn't
Dennis Skinner, that's right. Went around the House of the Commons when I was a VT and met him. And I didn't agree with his politics, but as someone who basically didn't pull any punches, said it like it was, and believed 100% in what he was saying.
Yeah.
You know, I admire that. I've always admired that.
But it's that thing, isn't it? You know, I want you to be able to say what you want. Yeah. I don't have to agree with you.
Yeah,
I want to live in a world where, and I think increasingly we seem to be in an age where people are very cautious.
Yeah, populist.
About, not just saying stuff that is popular and agreeable.
Yeah, definitely.
But you,
we need politicians like that to be put people to account, and you know, who are really not getting political, but who are interested in the country and its well-being as opposed to.
I think we need more now than ever before.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think someone was saying about, they were describing social media and they were saying that the one of the major flaws with it is you tend to curate your following around people you're interested in and who you like. Mm. But by virtue of that, you don't get any thoughts or opinions that challenge your way of thinking because everybody agrees with one another. So when something comes up that you don't agree with, it becomes quite binary in that they're wrong.
Mm. Because it's an echo chamber then, isn't it?
Yeah. Which is
going to be supported.
Which is unhealthy.
Adversarial, isn't it? I think it's that thing, as you say, you have the right to say what you want to say, like Dennis. You might not agree with him, but he has the right to say it.
Exactly. And I've changed my opinion on numerous occasions when, you know, presented with an argument that is a forceful argument that challenges my views, and it's either changed my view completely or it's tempered the view. So I've maybe not held on quite as dogmatically to a particular view. And I think that comes with age, though. That comes with maturity.
Yeah.
And, you know, just being exposed to all these various things. But I still, 9 times out of 10, the mouth is engaged before the brain is actually put into the ground. And I'll say things frequently and just think, oh, God, the wife particularly, she's like, you didn't say that, did you? I said, well, not quite like that, but actually, yes, I did.
Pretty similar.
So from relatively humble upbringing, a smart lad, so when did dentistry start to come into your thought process of being a potential career for you?
It was accidental. Completely and utterly accidental. I think my parents had always said go into something like medicine or pharmacy, and they were quite keen on the pharmacy side of things, but I was not particularly good at chemistry, and I thought, you know, I'm going to kill someone if I mix these drugs up incorrectly. So I was in that sort of lower six at university, which I don't know what year that is now, year 12 or whatever, way of thinking. And my friend at the time, he'd been hell-bent on doing dentistry since he was about 6 or 7.
Wow.
And he'd always gone down that line. And he said, you know, the Sheffield University have got this student for a day scheme and there's a spare space. It was before emails. They'd just phoned him and let him know. He said, do you fancy doing it? Because I know you're thinking along that, you know, the medical line. And I went, yeah, I'll go along. I'm not really thinking of dentistry. But actually, I enjoyed it a lot. The practical side of it and the day lectures and things. And I thought, yeah, I could do this. So I applied and, you know, lucky enough to get in. The sad thing is, Ashley, my mate who introduced me to it, didn't. He didn't.
Oh, really?
No. And he, I think he messed his A-levels up and ended up doing something else like biology. And then he's disappeared off to Canada, I think.
He's wow.
Probably living his best life over there. He hasn't got any GDC.
We talk to quite a lot of people where their kind of entry point to dentistry is quite often through work experience. At school, they get the opportunity to spend a day or a couple of days in a surgery and they're hooked. I know you're passionate about dentistry as part of wider society. Mm. Do you think there's more that can be done in those early days? Because particularly young people, they need to make these decisions, quite often career-bending decisions quite early on. Is there an opportunity for more to be done at the earlier stages to expose people to dentistry?
I think there is, but I'd turn it the other way and say that, you know, potentially we make our decisions very early about what we want to do.
Mm.
And, you know, an 18-year-old is only just able to vote, yet is being expected to make a decision that's going to last the rest of their life. Whereas
it's a big ask.
When you vote, you know, you've only got 5 years. If you mess it up, you can get another chance of voting for a bunch of incumbents. But with a career, you know, if you are being pressured into it by the wrong, I'll not say the wrong, but you're being pressured into it by expectations, say family expectations or your own expectations. I think America sometimes got a better idea that you do a degree first, then you go on and do dentistry as sort of a postgraduate thing. But the expense of that is going to be phenomenal, especially now with, you know, the way education is in higher education. But I think we could facilitate it more and better than we do. The problem would be, I think, if you exposed a lot of the younger, you know, students to some of the melting pots of the NHS, they would not want to do it. And it does surprise me sometimes that, you know, why some of them really do want to go into the profession. They obviously haven't worked in some of the environments that we all know about that are, you know, when I say toxic, I mean it's a toxic system that you're working within. I don't mean a toxic environment with regards people. We all know that can happen anyway, but you know, we know that the NHS contract is hugely flawed, and unfortunately I don't think their eyes are opened until they hit the ground at, you know, DF training years, or maybe a year or so before that. So we need to prepare them better, but without saying don't do it.
Yeah, without scaring people off.
Yeah, but you need to have your eyes wide open.
Yeah. You've owned your practice for 27 years.
Yeah, something like that.
Not an inconsiderable amount of time.
Yeah.
Back in 2005, you decided to go fully private for adults, continuing to treat kids on the NHS. Just kids, yeah. The what we call the new NHS contract came in 2006. Were those timelines linked? Did you make a decision that you didn't want to be part of that new process?
I absolutely made that decision. At the time, the sort of way that you found out a lot of stuff was Tony Jacobs' forum, GDP UK.
GDP UK, yeah.
And that was priceless. And I know sometimes people say, well, it's full of people who are moaning, but actually the amount of intel and intelligence experience of people on there, and what I could see coming down the line with this contract and all the things that they were trying to sell it to the profession with were all things that I couldn't put pen to paper and sign that and say ethically I can work within this contract. There were just too many things that I just thought, no, it's not going to let me do the dentistry I wanted to do, and I'm going to be forced to either change my ethics and my morals, or I'm going to go bankrupt. And I thought, you know, that's not much of a choice. So I thought, if I'm going to go bankrupt, I may as well do it on my own bat by going private first and seeing if going private makes me go bankrupt rather than...
I think it's a massive misconception of the general public, isn't it? They sort of always link NHS dentistry and the fact of, well, you're getting paid by the government, and they forget that you are actually self-employed businesses delivering a service. So you've got all the other bits going with it, because they sort of think of you like, I don't know, like a hospital, really, in a mini hostel. They say, oh, yeah, you know, well, it's fine. You're getting all this money from the government. What are you moaning about?
Exactly. And I think when I've been interviewed by the press or you know, various papers and things like that, I've started it off by saying every single high street dentist in the UK is a private practice. And it just so happens to maybe have one customer, which is the NHS. And once you get that in their mind, there's often a lot of understanding, but it takes a long time to chip away at the, you know, the psyche and the education or the lack of education. And there, to tell you the truth, there are other things that are more important to a lot of people. Dentistry at the moment is only important to people because they can't get it. As soon as they can get it, it'll then go on the back burner. It'll be the next thing.
That's so true, isn't it? That scarcity.
But notwithstanding all that, Simon, you did continue to take an NHS contract to be able to care for kids.
Yeah, I'm closet socialist still. that was the last bit that, you know, the I did feel at the time. I mean, Mansfield was, I think it was in 2008, they said it was the place second least likely to survive another recession.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, hang on, I've just bought a practice in this area because it lost all its pits. So you'd got this huge industry that was no more. Mm. And then what used to happen, it's quite a sort of a, I suppose it's like a little bit of a sexist thing still, that the men used to work down the pits and the women used to work in the hosiery trade and the shoe trade and as seamstresses. And of course that all disappeared as well. So Mansfield suddenly had nothing. And I'm buying a practice in an area that theoretically has got nothing. There's no industry there anymore. And then I'm thinking in 2005, I'm going to go private. What on earth is going to happen?
You say that, but it clearly worked for you because by 2011, you'd expanded to 5 surgeries. Yeah. And this is as a purely private practice apart from the kids. So notwithstanding the wider economic outlook, the recession that came through at the end of 2008, by 2011, you've got a much larger, thriving private practice in an area which wouldn't have been an obvious place to have a private practice.
I think what I'd always said there is the advantage of being in Mansfield is it was the peaks and troughs were a lot shallower. So when you had a recession, it took a couple of years to, because it wasn't there wasn't a lot of heavy industry to be hit. It was like call centres by then. So what happened, there was a bit of a lag effect. So you'd get this big peak and then a trough in, say, central London, where it was boom and bust.
Yeah, very high.
And then
in
Mansfield, it's just trickling along. So it's been like a little roller coaster, but a kiddie's roller coaster, very gentle.
Right.
And I think, I'll be honest, that's probably what's been my best decision. Accidentally is not to buy it in an area where it's particularly affected by the vagaries of, you know, spa dentistry or Invisalign or things like that, you know.
It's a ballsy move, isn't it, really, when you think, you know, you're going to give up that revenue. There must have been moments when in the run-up and after you've done it thinking, holy shit.
There were many moments like that. I think my wife's very, very supportive. She was my dental nurse in one of the practices that
I was going to say, were you able to share it with her?
Yeah.
But sort of that emotional roller coaster you're on.
I was, but she's a lot more matter of fact than I am. I get very matter of fact.
Flip.
Wow.
You're pretty... She's proper black and white. It is or it isn't.
Simon Gray Thackeray.
I'm not saying something, but it, I think she realized when I was talking about my plan B and my plan C one day about a week or so before. And we just had our first child. Well, our
good
child.
Timing.
So he was one. And I was busy working out the mortgage on our house at the time. I said, but why are you doing that? I said, just in case. And said, just in case what? I said, just in case the private conversion doesn't work. She said, well, what do you mean? I didn't think there was any issue that it might not work. I said, anything like that, a business decision where you are changing something so fundamentally, I could lose everything. And she's at that moment, she's like, have you sent the letters out? And I'm like, yeah. Well, did you not think about asking me first?
A bit late for that.
But the plan B, I would say to anybody who's thinking about it, and it sounds harsh, but the plan B for me would be to have downsized and then re-expanded. Because at the time I'd got two associates. One made a better conversion than the other because I think one of them was more married to the NHS than I realised.
Right.
So his book didn't convert in quite the same way, but it has done, and it's actually been, you know, very successful. Yeah. But you have to have, I think you've got to have a plan B, which is, right, well, it's me and a couple of staff. And unfortunately, if it's not going
to
work.
It just goes to show there, doesn't it, from what you're saying and the people listening, that having the right attitude to want to deliver it. You had one associate that was really up for it and one associate who wasn't really up for it. And surprise, surprise, their list didn't convert as well. You know, and it's what's going on up in your head, isn't it?
Well, if your attitude's not right, it's not going to happen. Same town, same practice, same probably demographic profile of patients.
Pretty much the same demographic. I mean, I think that's another thing that you've got to take into account. My demographic was always quite good because I think the practice had been there since the 50s, if not before that. And I'm still treating some patients who've only ever had two dentists, me and my predecessor. And I've got a significant number of people who've only ever seen the two of us, possibly even his predecessor. So the three of us are quite elderly patients. I've had three dentists in their lives.
Out of interest, Simon, so it's Thackeray Dental Care, and I'm going to make an assumption that you didn't just get lucky and buy a practice that's called Thackeray Dental Care. That'd be pretty uncanny. What was the logic and the rationale and the process you went through in changing a business name? Because there's risk attached to that as well.
Well, it didn't have a name before. It was just known as Mr. Ridley's Dental Practice.
So you couldn't keep that.
In the 1980s, it was the dental practice, Mr. Ridley's practice. And then next door was, I think, Jackson and Rigby's Dental Practice. And that was the name.
Wow. Right, so it was the name.
So as soon as I started, it was a case of he didn't tell anybody that it was retiring. So literally the patients came in on the 1st of January or whatever it was, 1998, and like, who the hell are you? I'm a new dentist.
Hello.
Let me introduce myself. That was an eye-opener because the number of people who left, and this has always fascinated me, they'll leave the practice because you're not the person who used to treat them, and they'll not give you a chance, but they'll go somewhere else to see.
They'll go to a new, completely new dentist that they've no idea.
It's not even the same surroundings, and that just, you know, perplexed me for a few months. It's like, why are you going somewhere else? Why don't you just give me a go? And then,
but also, all the other people, lots of the people from the practice prior to your purchase would probably still be there. So there would be still be faces they'd recognise. Oh, yeah. It's just literally the principal, the dentist had gone.
That was it. It was a single-handed practice, and it had got three of the smallest surgeries you've ever seen. one of them, if you imagine a small upstairs toilet, that had a chair in it.
Was it knee break chairs all around?
It was one of those old pump action things.
Oh, well.
1950s.
Tip your hands to the corridor.
And I think we had one room that had one of those sit-in Panorex machines where you where it was, and a dental chair. And that was the disability access surgery.
Wow.
So I think the most modern bit of equipment was a trophy X-ray unit that is actually still in service. It was a current one at the time. But everything else must have been about 40 years old.
I read an article recently, and I can't remember who it was by, and he was talking about the changing face of the high street and towns and how they've sort of evolved. Mm. And he said, but the things that are consistent, he said, is the dental practice. He said it is quite often one of the few businesses that is still in exactly the same place as it was 50 years ago or 40 years ago. He said, you know, everything else quite often comes and goes, cafes, restaurants. He said pubs sometimes, but a lot of pubs have closed. He said, but normally on a high street, he said the two things you could find would be the dental practice and maybe a pub. He said banks have gone. He said it's like the stable thing that is in the same location.
And I think that's why the Disability Discrimination Act and CQC came in, there were challenges because dental practices do occupy premises that are old and they're not fit for purpose and they're on multi-levels and they don't have access by ramp and all the other bits and pieces. And it's because they're in old, you know, well-established buildings, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, and that was the thing with my practice. It was a classic three up, three down, semi-detached building, but quite a big one. And luckily, it lent itself when I expanded into buying the building next door. The layout of it is not like a normal semi where the doors are at either end of it. Both front doors were in the middle, so we could actually make one big entrance hall.
Right.
So it actually looks like one building, designed as one building. But even then, you know, stripping it down to, you know, it's almost its component parts, it's trying to be disability compliant, was virtually impossible. And again, we couldn't do that without, we couldn't do it. We literally couldn't do it. It would have been so structurally impossible. We may as well have demolished the whole building and started again in a custom build. So I can see why people now are buying sort of empty units, out of town empty units, which are basically four walls, aren't they? And you stick
the walls in
and just build it like it is. I mean, classic example is that is Colin Campbell's absolutely stunning practice in Nottingham, and it's a revelation to go in there from anybody else's practice, because you're walking into this unbelievably well thought out facility that it's not a dental practice. It's far more space age. And there's a
car park of
jealousy. I'm going to see Colin, and it's like, you bugger.
So, Simon, you say that you're constantly surprised by any of the success you've had being down to luck more than planning. I have a notion that I think luck is opportunity plus preparation equals luck. So I don't think it's down to luck. But in hindsight, can you look backwards and look at key moments in your life and say that they were critical decisions you took, which perhaps at the time felt like luck, but they were more than that. They were actually thought out.
Yeah, I think actually buying the practice, that's probably one of the biggest ones, because I was all set to buy a different practice.
Right.
And I'd got the funds in place to buy a different practice. And it was it was before the time where you did proper due diligence. And it was just like, you know, the bank could say, "Have you got a business plan?" "No." "Well, we'll give you the money, but do us a business plan on a piece of paper and mail it in or whatever." And I did. That's how I did the business plan. And it was only when I then managed to finally get a whole load of NHS schedules for this practice, and I'll not say where it was, and give it away. But the proprietor is no longer of this earth anyway. He's no longer. it was a while ago. And I was wading through these schedules to work out what the gross was likely to be, so that I could work out what the profitability might be. And the schedules were for a different address. They weren't even for this practice. And when I actually then spoke to this guy, he says, "Oh yeah, well, as soon as you buy it, I'll shut that practice and I'll transfer all the patients over to you."
What?
And I'm like, okay, how far away can I run from this deal now? Because that really, even with my naivete, that didn't sound particularly...
Quite right.
Quite right. And what happened is I'd seen the practice that I'm now bought as one of the first ones I'd looked at, and I just literally walked in and was so shocked by how outdated it was. And how... I mean, in Mansfield, a lot of buildings have got subsidence. So there used to be a deal where you could get the coal board to refurbish your building and they would pay for it. But the deal was they refurbished it, they chose what colours it was going to be. And it literally, the inside, it was like army surplus khaki paint.
Oh, nice.
So the whole thing was this disgusting khaki brown cream. So you walked in and not only did it smell like a practice, it looked like nothing on earth. And I'd walked in and I just got this idea of what I wanted my practice to look like, and that wasn't it. But luckily Claire, my wife, had sort of seen the potential. She kept quiet about it because she liked this other practice as well. But when that fell through, I'd handed my notice in and everything, so it was all a case of, oh my god, you know, I'm now without a job, let's have another look at the Mansfield practice.
Wow.
And you know, that's what happened. So that was the look, I suppose. Wow. There. The other look was the fact that I had a bank manager who he's only just recently left Royal Bank of Scotland, and I've had him since I bought the practice, a guy called David Mee. And he understood me very, very quickly.
Mm.
And he's the guy who said, have you got a business plan? And I went, no, do I need one? And he gave me a piece of paper. He said, just do one now while I have a coffee. And that was it, literally. Planning or doing a business plan there.
That's what you like, succinct. A succinct plan. You don't need 50 pages to explain something.
Well, no, it was just a scribble. And I mean, I barely understood what it was. And I think that it was the look then that I bought at the right time.
Mm.
The goodwill value of practices was quite low. The goodwill of my practice was 10 grand.
Yeah.
But also, I think that thing about your bank manager, it's a little bit like if anyone's watched the program on BBC Dragon's Den. Now, when people invest in the business, very often they actually say, I'm investing in the person. It's I'm investing in your energy, your passion, your drive, you know, your commitment to this as a project. And I think your bank manager back in the day invested in Simon.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of is the right thing, because you would have done anything to have made this work. And he probably saw that in you, that whatever happened, you were not going to let him down. This was not going to fail. And I think, yes, the underlying business, particularly as goodwill values have got higher and higher, becomes more important. But I still think there's a person who's running the business. And I think if you don't understand the person, then you're not going to get the best outcome for everybody involved.
And the confidence to see the opportunities. It's that sort of thing, isn't it? It's, you know, it's khaki and cream and shit. And you can see it and go, I can't believe this is still a business that's making money and it's shit. So imagine when you overlay yourself into it, you can think, oh, actually, it can't be any worse than it is now. But that's still confidence, isn't it, to actually stand back and go.
And it comes across that way now as I look at it. But again, that moment where I signed pen on paper and started work that first, or it became mine on something like the 23rd of December, but I wasn't starting until the 2nd of January. We went in over that Christmas and redecorated it.
Wow.
Before
what were the staff like? Sorry, were the staff welcoming, or were they, sort of a mixed?
The staff were very welcoming, apart from the technician who used to work in the room above that. Had a very interesting, we can't ever work out what the dynamic was between him and the owner, but it was a very, very strange relationship. And I'd said, as soon as I was, you know, looking at buying this place, I want that room, that technician's room, is a huge room to make into a surgery. So part of my deal with RBS was they gave me 30 grand up front as well to buy a surgery, and I actually put a brand new surgery in within the first month of buying it. And that was because there's no way I could have worked in those other surgeries to do the dentistry that I wanted to do. So I put a brand new surgery in, and he did not take it well. There were all sorts of things on it was in the days of paper, obviously paper records. And we wondered why we'd got these patients who'd obviously been coming to the practice for 30 years or so. There were no records for them. Eventually we had to get the police involved because we suspected that he'd been doing something with the records and taking them and disposing of something.
Wow.
There's other things. The place nearly burnt down on the second day. And then I had, I'd been in there about a week, and some gentlemen decided they would like to tarmac my drive as a favour, and then charge me £1,000 for doing it.
Oh, really?
So I had that, and I'm thinking about,
yeah, I've got some spare.
I've got some spare tarmac. Would you like it doing? I said, we've got some spare. That'd be quite generous of you.
It was quite prevalent in Leeds at one time.
I think it might have been the same people.
And they were terrible. They would they'd do it, and then if you didn't pay, they would send like funeral directors to your house and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that people would pretty knock aggressive on your door and they'd say, I understand someone's died. And they'd say, well, no. It was their implied threats that unless you paid.
I think the daft thing is, even though I know I was being ripped off, that tarmac is actually still down. It's about the only bit of the practice that hasn't been replaced.
The irony.
It's not got weeds or anything through it. So they actually did it quite well. But
good job.
Probably the most expensive piece of tarmac ever.
Yeah.
Unless the NHS, of course.
It's probably linked to the M1 somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. It's got, still got the white lines on it.
Yeah.
Before we move on to the other aspects of your career away from the practice, just to kind of finish this chapter, what would you take away as your key entrepreneurial learning from your journey of owning a dental practice? If you had to distill it down to one thing.
It would be, don't panic about the numbers, but know the numbers. And my problem is I still don't know the numbers and I panic about them. But I think that I do know the numbers better than a lot of people, but I don't know them as well as others and in other businesses. And I think it's, don't chase the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Be yourself, be the best version of you and know what the numbers need to be, but don't go out there looking at the numbers as being some kind of target for the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very, very, very against target-driven dentistry in all ways. And again, I think that was probably a reason why I didn't like the NHS contract, because I thought, he's going to be saying, you're going to hit this target. You're going to hit this target. Hit this target.
Yeah.
And it's always sort of sat against what I believed in. You know, the general, the Dentist Act says, or the GDC says, you won't be affected. You know, you won't work to targets and have a malign incentive to work towards targets. But that essentially is what the NHS contract is.
Mm. Yeah.
I think there's too much emphasis these days on more and more and more rather than better.
Mm.
So if I'm going to distill it, it's don't chase the money. Know that it's needed to make your business healthy, but be the best person you can. And you won't make as much money, but it is all the more rewarding knowing how you've earned it.
I mean, we operate in a completely different world to you, but our accountant always has a phrase which I quite like, which is money follows the event.
I think so you're right. Yeah.
You do the right thing and you just keep doing the right thing and the money flows from the work you do. You don't have the other way around, which is, you know, you chase the money and you do the thing. Just do the thing well. And if you keep doing the thing well, the money will naturally fix itself.
And I think that's one of the problems now. This is one of the things that I get really wound up about, is that it's all about more, and it's more money, more this, more that, more the other. It's not about being better and better for your patients and offering your patients better. It's offering them more. Now, that doesn't mean to say I won't offer them a broad range of things, but I'm not going chasing. I don't class patients as leads, for instance. I don't like that kind of language. That's 1980s selling language as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, there's no greater privilege than to have the skill that we have to be able to
change someone's life.
Yeah.
You know, this is it. You can change someone's life for the better, but unfortunately, you can change it for the worst as well.
Yes.
You've always got to be wary. And I think I can get a bit jaded sometimes with my profession because I do a lot of medico-legal work.
Mm.
So of course, by the time I see something, it's gone very wrong usually.
Yeah.
And there's no shortage of that amount of work. Mm. As a percentage of what the profession is producing, it's still a very small amount. But of course, I get to see more of it.
And yeah, you've got a skewed view, yeah.
I've got a very skewed view. But sometimes you can see, I know what that conversation was that got you into that position as a dentist or as a patient.
Mm.
I can, you know, this is a, you know, potentially this is somebody chasing the money rather than thinking what's the right thing to do here.
I know back in during lockdown, you were one of the instrumental figures in setting up the BAPD, the British Association of Private Dentistry. And I assume that was kind of partly driven by your concern for the future of dentistry. And whilst it is the BAPD, I know it also talks generally for dentists. Whilst private dentistry is in the name, it's more general than that. But I might regret asking this, but what are your thoughts about the future of dentistry?
Oh, God. How long have we got? There's just two or episode 10. The future of dentistry is safe in that there are still 60 million people with mouths, with teeth in them, or not, as the case may be, because it doesn't really matter if they have or haven't got teeth. there's going to be an increase in the way dentistry is provided, I think, in that there might well be more emphasis on the skill mix, but that's going to take a long time to come to fruition because there still aren't as many say delivery by hygienist therapist or therapist. There aren't as many therapists as there are dentists. So you've really got to change the whole training structure around massively and increase the number of therapists massively. Plus, you've probably got the legislative changes that are needed then to allow therapists to work within the NHS as a sole contractor if they want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an exciting future, definitely.
Mm. Still a slow burn, though, isn't it?
It is a slow burn, but I think it sort of splits into two at the moment. The future of dentistry, the future of NHS dentistry is looking grim. And, you know, I say this not just as my position on the BAPD, but I also sit on the BDA's General Dental Practice Committee. So I've got a pretty good insight into the mm-hmm. machinations of what's going on with the NHS, which sort of sometimes shoots down those critics of the BAPD who says, well, what do you guys know about the NHS? Well, we need to know quite a bit about the NHS because we need to know what's affecting the profession as to why people might end up going private.
Mm.
What is that practice's particular concern about the NHS that might mean they want to go private? So we've got to be skilled up and we've got to have the knowledge and the intel and, you know, the personal intelligence to be able to criticise and comment on that. But no, we're certainly not going to sit there and say this is what a new contract needs to be. But I think the government's responsibility, it's the government who need to get their act together to provide a system, not the responsibility of individual dentists to keep shoring it up.
Mm.
And they're relying, same as they are with the doctors, they're relying on the goodwill of the individuals. And that, you know, as I said earlier, that privilege that we've got to look after another human being, they're relying on that. More they're relying on the fact that we've got to change this and we've got to make it equitable for everybody, patients and dentists alike. At the moment, the only people it's equitable for is the Treasury.
Mm. And the goodwill wears thin, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And
also, well, it's worn thin now, hasn't it?
And with new dentists, it's, you know, they haven't got that ability to sort of almost fall back on traditional historical past of people. It's like, you know, this is the new guys coming to the market. This is what they look at.
And also, I think lots of the newly qualified dentists, you know, we speak to lots of younger dentists and they kind of literally, as soon as they get through their foundation year, they're off. They want to move into private practice.
They don't see a future in the NHS.
No.
And, you know, that used to be, it's a pun, isn't it? But it's where I cut my teeth. That's how I actually learned how to do my endo, how I learned how to do full mouth rehabs. God, I used to do, you know, literally stuff that a lot of the younger dentists are now scared of doing. And I would do it on the NHS. I had a particularly good VT trainer because that's how old I am, because it was vocational training there.
Yeah.
And, he, you know, literally my first 2 weeks, he'd got two or three patients in and they were full mouth rehabs that you'd be looking at now thinking, you know, where do I start?
But is that old school dentistry though, where you ran and you do run a general practice? So most things that come into your surgery, you could treat. Sure, there might be a specialist that you'd refer out to, but most general dentistry you can do. Whereas, are we potentially ending up with younger dentists who are good at a very specific element?
Yes,
but they're not broad in their application.
It's one of the things that does concern me a little bit, because you see a lot of them very concentrated on doing the align and bonding kind of thing, kind of dentistry that they see. And it's fantastic being able to do that. But actually, you need to know how to restore all that when it goes wrong. You need to know what's wrong with the occlusion, which is one of the basic fundamentals of dentistry. It's what everything stems from. It's why just about everything goes wrong in dentistry. And if they focus too much on that one aspect, what happens if that aspect dries up?
Yeah.
You know, what happens if suddenly, you know, the thing at the moment they're talking about, Invisalign adding 20% VAT on.
Yeah,
because it's seen as a cosmetic treatment. Well, if it becomes a cosmetic treatment and it's then taken away, say, from dentists, you know, what if that happens? Like, you know, Smile Direct Club, look at the outcry when, you know,
was
taken away, or part of that, you know, that income stream is taken away by a competitor.
Mm.
You put all your eggs in one basket. It's a little bit like going down the line of just being an NHS dentist and doing no private work.
Mm.
You know, when the NHS is on its knees like it is, and you have the practice that's got all the NHS patients that won't convert or can't convert, you're stuck in the middle. When the recession hits and people are not wanting to have the discretionary spend on a line and bonding, and you've put all your eggs in that one basket.
You're in trouble.
And you're in trouble. Whereas the general dentist, like myself, is like, well, yes, Mr. Smith, you might not be able to afford Invisalign, but you still need three fillings. Should we book you in and I'll get those three fillings done and let's work out why you need those three fillings?
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you do have to be a jack of all trades.
Yeah. We always think NHS as well. I mean, we're not clinicians at all, but we always say that it's great for learning communication skills. Because
you've got time.
Yeah, because you speak, you see so many different people that you sort of have a whole broad range of different patients sitting in your chair. And it's sort of, I think sometimes people just, well, I don't know really. It's just, I think our younger generation is losing the ability to communicate. I think it's where I find sometimes.
Yeah, I think a lot of the communication skills are what, or a lack of communication skills are what, and result in people ending up in trouble with the GDC and in litigation. You can see, you know, sometimes when you look at the way that the information is presented to an expert witness, you can read through it and you think that's where you stopped communicating or that's where it went wrong. And I don't know why that is. I mean, I've got my own personal theories, and one of them is that as you get more demand for, say, dentistry, the way that they select the students to go into dentistry, there aren't many different ways that they can select them now other than sheer academic ability. Now,
that's interesting.
A good academic ability does not mean you're a good communicator.
No, that's interesting.
You could be the geekiest person out there.
Yeah.
Won't even say boo to a goose, but you are straight A plus candidate. Then they drop you into something where you are, you know, communicating with other human beings who are not necessarily as blessed with the same kind of ability to communicate, often a better communication skill, but also they're not necessarily as intelligent. And I'm generalizing, but a lot of your patients, if you start talking to them in jargon, they're just going to gloss over.
Yeah,
you can't then turn around and say, well, I told you about this. Well,
it's an interesting point. Actually, I just think about my kids when they went to university and they came out with their degrees and they were like, I think they all got 2-1s. And it was like, you don't want a first because the firsts are the guys who never go out or do anything.
And you do wonder if that's what
it's fascinating. Just listening to you, and I'm thinking, hey, maybe you're right. You know, right. Obviously, there are some people with firsts who have personalities. We are generalizing, chaps.
But I think you only have to look sometimes at the interactions that some people have. And the question is, are you so intelligent you can't actually relate to other people?
Yeah.
And is that where it then goes wrong? I don't know. There's probably a PhD psychology degree in here.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Somebody to actually research that. But, you know.
I saw this late. I was talking to a girl from King's. She's a final year student. And I was talking to her and she said, you know, she did a fill-in. And she said, I wrote 3 pages of notes on the fill-in. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, right, well, hang on a minute, you're going to get paid whatever it is for your UDA.
And if you've written those 3 pages of notes, how much of that is actually relevant? How much of that is covering your own backside?
Yeah, well, that's what she was saying, yeah.
But an expert witness like myself will turn around and say, well, in that kind of appointment, you wouldn't have time to write all that. And the procedure has actually taken less time than it took you to write the note.
Yeah.
And it's gone a little bit silly with the, you know, the way that the GDC went and prosecuted people and the no-win, no-fee solicitors. You know, we've become an easy target.
Yeah, definitely.
In a lot of respects. And there's a lot of us now sort of fighting back against this. You don't really need to write this amount of detail in the notes. You need to write what's relevant.
Be concise.
And be concise. Mm. What's relevant and what's...
What's that? Dental law partnership, isn't it?
And they will find something. And I mean, you know, most records, even mine, there will be a gap somewhere in it that is not done deliberately. It's just, you know, you can't quite recall what was said or how it was said. Are you going to record which colour wedge you used? I mean, for goodness sake, that is something that is a drop down on my clinical records that I don't use. Blue Wedge used. Why is it so relevant? It was a Blue Wedge.
If we had to distill it down, we've got government, NHS England, GDC, and I just hand you a magic wand and you can wave your magic wand. What are the one, two, or a push? You can have three things.
And you've got 3 minutes.
That need fixing. Yeah.
Right. I only need two. One is a new dentist act, and it needs to change completely how the GDC operates.
Right.
So that's one. The dentist act needs updating and changing completely. So
when was it last truly updated?
1984, but it's had statutory instruments at several levels to do things like allowing registration of nurses and changing things with the registration of.
But the core documents back to 1984.
Would you on the GDC side? Would you want the GDC to be more supportive over dentistry than as it's seen, which is seen as adversarial to dentistry?
It needs to be, but I understand where they're coming from, because as a statutory body, it's not there for the dentists. It's there for the public.
To protect the patients.
To protect the patients. But what it needs to do it is do it in a way that isn't as adversarial.
Yeah.
And I think it knows that it's had years where it has literally been seen as...
Yeah,
you know, the slightly more vigorous version of the Stasi.
I think taking adverts in the broadsheet newspapers.
That was. I mean, that this is part of what I'll say about my fly on the wall thing in a bit. But you know, the GDC is not there to support us, but it can be supportive.
Yes,
and I think it needs to stop harping on about legislation and blaming the legislation. Until it gets its own house in order. And I'm not sure when this is going out, this podcast.
But this will probably go out about March time.
So it's still going to be relevant that there's just recently been another case that the GDC have had to take to appeal where they've been told they've been operating incorrectly and prosecuting incorrectly to do with suspensions. And a High Court judge has ruled that the way that you're operating suspensions and immediate suspensions and then suspensions after after a case, they're latching them together instead of running them concurrently like they would in the normal court of law. Wow. And the GDC are saying, yes, but we're right, but we're right, but we're right. And it's now going to go to the appeal court because the GDC want to insist that they're right. Now, hang on a minute. You've had this legislation since 1984 and you don't know how to operate it.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's taken a challenge here. And I mean, personally, I'd be partly blaming the indemnity companies for not jumping on it sooner as well. But you've then got the case last year, the Williams case, where they had three High Court judges in the appeal court tell them that they were wrong.
Yeah.
Is that the one with the patient charges?
Yeah, that's the patient charges one. Yeah. So you've got this bit of legislation that you're operating under, and the courts are saying you don't know how to use it. So they need a piece of very, very simple legislation that's up to the task so it can support things like modern dentistry. So there's things in there that will take into account things like direct to public, you know, Smile Direct Club. The GDC don't believe that they had any remit over Smile Direct Club, even though they were providing dentistry, and the practice of dentistry is what they regulate.
Didn't they take the line that they said they only regulated people who were on the GDC register? And their point was that...
So let's all come off the GDC regular.
Legally,
you know.
But I guess fundamentally, you've got an act that was drawn in 1984. If you think how much dentistry's changed since 1984, it's a different beast, isn't it?
I wasn't even qualified in 84. I started university in 1987. It's changed beyond all recognition. And the Act hasn't. So there's your first thing. The second thing I'd want is, if we're going to have an NHS service, it needs to be a core service that's means tested. And it's offered appropriately to those people who can't afford it. Not the people who won't afford it. There's a big... you know, there's always going to be people who won't afford things that you tell them they need to have done. And it's not because they can't afford it, because they've got, you know, they've got Sky TV or whatever. If they need to, they can make the commitment to do those things. But there needs to be a safety net, and it needs to be a robust one, and it needs to be a fair one. The problem will be everybody who says, we'll have a core service, you won't have the same amount of funding as you've got now, the 1.8 billion or the 3.1 billion as they keep saying it is, but then of course 1.7 billion of that is patient charges, isn't it? So you've got this 1.7 billion pounds or 1.5 billion pounds that the government are giving.
Yeah.
Let's face it, they're not going to give the full 3.1 billion.
Yeah. You're not going to get more money, is it?
But if they gave that amount, I think you'd probably find there would be dentists then who would be happy to provide a core service if it was, funded appropriately.
Mm.
But the government just doesn't trust dentists as well, because they think that as soon as we give you something, there'll be people who will try and game it, and there will be a minimum number of people who do that. Anyway, they'll always look at the...
I always think that's the worst thing with poor old dentists is you sort of, whether it be CQC or whatever, the assumption is that you're all a bunch of scamming, dodgy dudes, aren't you? So your lowest common denominator is like virtually off the floor, rather than we used to work in a bank and banks did exception reporting, The assumption is everyone's okay, and if it goes above a certain point, then you look at it. But I always feel the dentist gets the wrong way around.
I was going to say, the way the government looks at it is we're all highly dodgy people.
Yeah.
But there have been examples where, they base that on the fact that there have been dodgy people in dentistry. I don't think we've got any more as a percentage than any other industry.
I don't think so. And generally, I would say most, from a banking point of view, most people are just normal people. There are the dodgy dudes, but there's dodgy car dealers, there's dodgy restaurateurs, there's dodgy whatever.
Yeah.
Every industry is going to have that. Every industry. But unfortunately, I think we get tarred with that brush.
Yeah, definitely.
And that might be, it's a legacy of the past where there were perhaps the digging for gold dentists. And
I was going to say the old trench.
your first car was a Bentley, and your second month you'd buy your first house. I knew of people who were of that era in dentistry. So if you're going to change two things, you'd change the regulator's remit, and you'd actually put the team that they've got at the moment with the BAPD. We do speak to them fairly regularly, and they do seem, the new chair of the GDC, Toby Harris, Lord Harris, really approachable guy. He's a consummate politician. He knows what he's doing, but I think he is distancing the GDC from the years previous, where we know it was the slightly harsher brother of,
as you say, the Stasi. It's quite good though, isn't it, that he wants to try and create that delineation, that
it's sort of whether or not he's able to do it with the legislation he's got. But my argument, and again the BAPD's argument, I'm not speaking for the BAPD, it's just me, but one of the things is you can interpret legislation is often there to be interpreted, because the government, when setting it, they don't write it in such a robust manner that there is no room for flexibility at all. There is, that's because of the way our legislation is written. We're not a codified, we don't have a constitution. We have these things that are set on precedent. So when a judge actually says, well, this is what I think the intent of Parliament was when this was written, and makes a judgment based on what he thinks that intent was. Sometimes it's very clear, murder is murder is murder, but even murder has grey areas. So when you've got legislation that can be interpreted, you can interpret it both ways.
Sure.
Seems to be a computer says no, that's how we're going to do it.
Yeah.
Until the
before we go on to our last two questions that we're gonna put your way, we've talked before about social media.
Yeah.
What would you see as good use of social media to advance the profession?
Educating your patients, making them more aware of the health issues in a way that isn't just boring rehashing of almost like textbook stuff like leaflets. Showing patients what's available, but not in a way that is about, look at me, look at how poor your life must be because you don't look like this. It's that kind of thing. There's a very fine line there, because obviously that ends up in marketing. And I don't have a problem with marketing using social media, but it's got to be very, very ethical.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's a free-for-all at the moment. You can literally, as long as it doesn't breach advertising standards and it doesn't breach anything sort of legally, you can say what you want and do what you want, almost with impunity. I think the problem with social media is you've got to remember it's not all real, and too many people are, you know, they see what's on social media and they will either have the fear of missing out. So I suppose there's that aspect of marketing, but there's also it can be very toxic. I don't spend very much time on social media at all now. I used to be one of the admins on one of the big Facebook groups and walked away from it. Because of the toxicity. A lot of people will say things on social media that they wouldn't say to your face.
Oh, so much so.
Yeah.
You know, the keyboard warrior is a nightmare. But I think I wouldn't stop social media, but I would certainly, I think a lot of people need to look at how they use it and how damaging that can be to other people.
Yeah.
In the way that they actually do it, and how and
sometimes unintentionally, showing off, showing off in the sense of putting things out there which aren't available to other people or aren't achievable by other people.
Yeah. Look how poor your life is going to be still because you can't have this.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is it's the mechanism for some people to show the pictures of them attending the opening of an envelope.
The
number of faces that you sometimes see. And you're just like, oh, you again? Do you actually do any work? You know what I mean? And it's, I'm not sure what the patients think of that, but I know what the profession sometimes thinks of that kind of thing. So we do have to be careful. We've got a responsibility.
Yeah.
We've got a responsibility to educate our patients and to show them things in the best possible light, but not to make them feel bad about themselves.
No, true. Yeah. Very true.
Yeah. Simon, we've got to that time where we need to ask you two questions before you're allowed to leave. So the first question we have for you is, if you could be a fly on the wall, and I think we kind of got a we've got an inkling where this might be going, but if you could be a fly on a wall in a situation, when would that be? Who would be there and what would be going on?
So can I have two situations? The first one is a dental one. First one is a dental one, and it's the fly on the wall of those conversations that the previous chair of the GDC had that caused the internal conversations that caused the GDC to go from something that was respected, largely respected, to largely reviled in a very, very short period of time. I would love to know what those conversations were. Were they along the lines of, we're going to beat them with a stick and we're going to, you know, we're going to prosecute them until they, you know, they've got no will left? Or was it, you know,
let's beat it out of them?
Was it, oops, we didn't mean that?
I actually didn't mean that. Sorry, yeah. So I've said it. So that would be my dental one. My non-dental one would, I'd love to have been a fly on the wall on D-Day in the headquarters listening to what reports were going to General Eisenhower. I do a lot of military history. I've got loads and loads of military texts and things that I read, so I'm quite an avid historian of the Second World War, particularly D-Day, and I would love to have known what was going on in that room at the various points where he was thinking, oh my god, what have we done, biggest invasion ever, and I'm responsible for it.
When do I know whether I issued this note
exactly
or this note?
Yeah,
because he wrote two notes.
He
one that was like, we've done it, and another one that said, oops,
yeah,
it hasn't quite worked. It's true though, isn't it? It's fascinating. It's when was that point when you thought, yeah, I can probably say the positive one. We're doing all right.
When did they tell him we're doing all right? So that would be my two.
Interesting. And then the follow-up question is, you're given the opportunity to sit down and have a pint of ale, a glass of wine, a bottle of milk, whatever your choosing is, with somebody. Who would you like
Yorkshire,
to...
It might be a stout.
It could be.
It's not stout, no.
It's not stout.
It would be my maternal grandfather, who I never met. He died sort of 17, 18 years before I was born. But he was unusual in that he was a Royal Marine in the First World War. and in the Second World War.
In the First World War?
But not only in the First World War. He was in the Marines before the First World War when it was the Royal Marines Infantry and the Royal Marines Light Artillery. Sorry, yeah. The Royal Marines Artillery and the Royal Marines Light Infantry. So he was in both of those. He was shipped off to Gallipoli, which was one of the big battles at the beginning of the war.
That worked well.
He was taken off the front line at Gallipoli and put on a ship where he thought he was coming back to the UK, but the ship took a right turn and ended up sending him to the Somme. So he jumped out of one frying pan into the fire, was blown up in the Somme. That's where he met my grandma. But then in between the First and Second World Wars, he served on the Royal Yachts. The previous Royal Yachts to the one that was to Britannia. And he knew people like Louis Mountbatten. And had danced with the Emperor of Japan before Japan started, you know, in the Second World War. And so she had lots of stories, but he would have had an awful lot of stories.
Yeah, I bet given
your interest in military as hell.
Then in the Second World War, he was the Provost Sergeant, Colour Sergeant Major at Plymouth Barracks. And he was in charge of, every time there was an air raid, he was basically the jailer. So every time there was an air raid, he had to run down and unlock all the cells. So if the barracks was bombed, the prisoners wouldn't get, you know, weren't locked in.
Yeah.
He had a chance to escape, and not one of them ever escaped. They were so scared of him.
Wow. Oh, he sounds like a right character.
That's a guy that you'd love. That would have been a memoir or something, wouldn't you?
Yeah. So I would have loved to have met him and had a few conversations.
Oh, lovely. It's lovely to hear those stories about him as well, because it kind of keeps him going in a certain way, doesn't it? Simon, it's been a joy. It's been an absolute joy. Thank you for your time. We managed to just about scratch the surface of lots of topics today. So,
not need a solicitor as well, which is unusual for me.
No, it's absolutely brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. And no doubt we'll be bumping into one another a dental show at sometime soon.
Almost certainly. Thanks.
Cheers, Simon.
Brilliant. Cheers, Simon. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.